Good morning, everybody. My name is Robert Lamb. I am a senior fellow and director of the Program on Crisis, Conflict, and Cooperation here at CSIS. Welcome and thank you for coming there between Emancipation Day, Holy Week, Spring Break, and a Red Line train breakdown. I am pleased to see that we actually have a pretty reasonable turnout given the prevailing winds. The prevailing winds also being a declining interest in the region, as far as I've seen over the past couple of years, which has been a bit sobering. I am very pleased to have with me here today some folks from the Center for International Private Enterprise, who are going to be talking about some work that they've been doing on Pakistan in partnership with a group called Prime. The Policy Research Institute of Market Economy, based in Islamabad, I think, right? And so, believe it or not, I actually have three people here with me. The third is in. Mark Schlieffer is the Regional Director for Eurasia and South Asia at the Center for International Private Enterprise, or CIPE, I believe you pronounce it. Has sort of overall responsibility for CIPE's relationship with this particular project. Ali Salman is actually on the telephone from Islamabad with us, where he's probably missing dinner right about now. He's the author of several studies and monographs for different media publications, and is the person who led the work on the scorecard that he's going to be presenting later today. Just a few minutes, actually. And Khurram Hussain is a Pakistan scholar at the Asia program at the Wilson Center, who will be our discussant for this conversation. Before I turn it over to Mark to introduce the project, I wanted to just briefly go around the room. So I mean, it's a small enough group that we can all know who each other are. So I'll just model brief. I'm Robert Lamb, senior director and senior fellow at CSIS. I've already introduced you. So, sir.
Hi, John Sullivan with CIPE.
Okay. I will ask you to use the microphones because we're videotaping it. We're not live streaming this on the internet, but we are videotaping it and we'll post it afterwards. So this is not an off-the-record, intimate, private roundtable. This is a public conversation that thousands of people will watch via iTunes U. So to turn the microphone on, there's a little button in the front. Thanks.
My name is Kurt Hageman. I'm from the global sector at CIPE.
You also don't need to get really close to the microphone.
I am April Snedeker, Program Assistant for Eurasia and South Asia at CIPE.
Hi, I'm Leah Grigg. I'm with DAI.
I'm Ellen Van Eek, and I'm also with DAI.
I'm Kat Cooley, also with DAI.
Pete Gauthier with USAID's Development Credit Authority.
I'm Perka Ahmed. I'm at CIPE, and I'm currently at CICE.
I'm John Sampson with International Relief and Development.
Kim Betcher, CIPE.
Anna Dawson, Communications Assistant at CIPE.
Anna Nagrekovic, Director of Multi-Regional Programs at CIPE.
Tim Wallace, CIPE.
Greg Wilhauk, Director of Government Relations and Afghanistan Program Officer for CIPE.
Andrew Wilson, CIPE.
Jennifer Anderson, CIPE.
All right, so thanks, everyone. So as you know, it was about a year ago that Pakistan held a fairly historic election. It represented a time when a civilian government survived its entire term without getting overthrown. And was succeeded by a democratically elected civilian government. The current government, PMLN, has put out a policy program obviously deals with a wide range of issues on the economic side of things. The issues are particularly important because, as we all know, Pakistan's economy is it has been in terrible shape for quite a long time. There's a jobs crisis. There is a severe energy crisis that's dragging down Pakistan's ability to raise revenue for its businesses to operate, factories for civilians to have light on at night. And it's been a major drag on its economy. And as well, there's a great deal of poverty and inequality in Pakistan that is also creating an enormous drag on its economy. The one of the things that I like about the Center for International Private Enterprise is they've been looking at these issues, the role of the private sector in development for many decades, longer than almost anyone else. They have an extremely high and deep level of knowledge about different parts of the world and a great deal of experience on the ground and managing projects. And so I'm delighted that I had the opportunity this morning to partner with all of you to help release this report. We're very much looking forward to hearing the results of the scorecard to see how the PMLN government has done in its first year. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mark Schlieffer for some introductory remarks. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Bob, and thanks, of course, to CSIS for hosting us and for giving us the opportunity this morning to give Ali Salman and Prime the opportunity to share their work with an audience in Washington. I'm just going to make a few remarks before we turn it over to Ali to present the results of the scorecard. And just give you a sense of the genesis of this project and how this research came about. CIPES had a field office in Karachi for about 7 years. And one of the things that we've done on a regular basis is host a conference of all of the presidents of all of the chambers of commerce from across the country. When we first opened our office, we found that the business community was reluctant really to come together around any sort of unified policy message. In fact, getting them even in the same room was rather difficult. With time, we began to see progress in terms of their willingness to talk about policy issues and to work in a transparent fashion with the government to try to push for an agenda and to speak publicly and to reach out to the media and whatnot. The President's Conference that we hosted every year started issuing an annual declaration. They do it in a place in Pakistan, not far from Islamabad, called Bourbon, and they call it the Bourbon Declaration, which is an annual sort of summation of their key policy demands for the year. And as Bob alluded to in the run-up to the historic June 2013 elections, we knew that we had to encourage our partners in the business community who organized this conference together with us to sort of take it to the next level. With the increasingly optimistic signs that we were getting as the June 2013 elections neared, that the previous government would actually serve out its full term, we knew that it was important to try to encourage those elections to be contested on a policy basis rather than personality-based politics. So with our partners in the lead, what they did in that conference was they invited representatives of all of the political parties to actually show up and for the first time really listen to the business community articulate its needs for policy reform. Representatives of the five major parties, including the three sort of major parties that contested the elections, sent their chiefs of economic policy to this president's conference. and really engaged in a dialogue with the business community for the first time. And one of the demands that emerged was that the parties articulate a concrete policy vision for the elections and write an economic platform, or a manifesto, as they sometimes call it, an economic agenda as part of their party platform for those elections, and actually campaign on that basis. So fast forward to after these historic elections, when a new government comes into power, we were sitting with Ali Salman in Islamabad, and we were talking about what comes next. And we said, well, you know, we can't just leave it at sort of they wrote this economic agenda and they campaigned on it, and sort of where do we go from here? And the idea that came out of that conversation was, well, let's take everything that the government promised to do and write it down and measure their progress in implementing it on a quarterly basis. Then partnering with key players in the business community, let's bring some sort of amplification to that through the media, through debates in civil society organizations and whatnot. And after some time, with some limited financial and some technical assistance from SIPE, what Ali Salman and his colleagues at the Prime Think Tank came up with is the scorecard project that he'll be presenting to you today. The original idea that we had was to try to do this at both the national and at the provincial levels. Sort of bearing in mind the constraints of doing this for the first time, where for now we're doing it only at the national level. And the approach is pretty simple. The government promised to do a lot of things, or the then candidates promised to do a lot of things. You write them down and you measure them. Some of this information, as Ali will explain, can be gathered from public sources, various government websites, the State Bank of Pakistan. Some of it can be gathered from, you know, World Bank or IMF sources. Some of it is pure numbers that you can evaluate. You know, they promise to, he'll get into the details a little bit, but make certain changes in terms of, let's say, tax to GDP ratio. It's fairly easy to check whether that's happening or not. Other issues concern more the development and passage of legislation, and that tracking takes place both by monitoring legislative developments in Parliament and also by monitoring the media. And then Ali and his team assign a score to that. What he's actually going to be presenting for you today is the second in a series of scorecards. So the elections were in June. It took a little while to ramp the project idea up. So the first scorecard came out in January, which covered the first six or so months of the new government. And this scorecard today now is going to cover that period from about January until through the end of March. And the idea here is, SIPE's planning to keep this going on a quarterly basis for at least for the foreseeable future, working with Prime. What's interesting, I think, and this sort of just to wrap it up on this, and then I'll turn it over to Ali via our telephone link, is that SIPE is our interest in this is not just from Pakistan's economic development point of view. SIPE is a democracy organization, and our funding for this project, and indeed many of our projects, comes from the National Endowment for Democracy. And so our interest really here is from a government accountability point of view. It's about establishing a track record of performance and interacting with civil society and the business community to put that track record out there publicly so that citizens have the opportunity and the information to make an objective evaluation of their government's performance, and then to use that information going forward in their electoral behavior in the future. And, you know, the idea here is that you've got indigenous groups in Pakistan from the think tank side and the business community side that are, as we would say, you know, holding the government's feet to the fire in terms of performance, but also looking to improve that performance going forward, and also looking to make sure that citizens have the information they need to make decisions about what kind of government they want. Without any further ado, I think I'll turn it over to Ali, and he will present the results to you of the second quarterly scorecard.
Thank you, Ali Salman. Please proceed with your presentation.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning. Am I clear and am I audible to all of you?
Yes, you are. Please go ahead, Ali. We hear you.
Great. So, good morning once again. I'm thankful to SIPE and CSIS to provide us prime an opportunity to share the results of the second tracking report of the government economic agenda. And Mark has already provided you the background. And the purpose of the scorecard reporting. So I'm going to jump over directly. Firstly, I'll explain how we measure score, on what criteria do we measure score, how we assign it, and then the results. First of all, I'd like to share a couple of important things that since we launched this report in January, it has been received positively by the press and electronic media. They have run their own stories. And I'm told by friends at in the government that when we circulated the reports, the first tracking report to the parliamentarians, the Prime Minister of Pakistan actually has asked the planning ministry to prepare a similar scorecard breakdown into ministries and the breakdown of manifesto goes in the ministry. So this shows that this kind of work, if consistently carried out in an objective manner, does have an impact in terms of raising citizens' voice and building pressure on the government to perform. So I am assuming that the presentation is on. So I am. Can it be turned to this slide number 2, where how do we score them is mentioned?
We're there, Ali.
Yeah. So the score is essentially assigns a score on each of the economic goal we have identified. We have broken down the manifesto into 91 quantifiable and measurable goals. And basis on the information available, we have given on each indicator a score from 0 to 10. And as you can see on your slides, out of 10, we have 2.5 for policy development and 2.5 for institutional reforms or governance and 5 for implementation. We have developed general rules in which we say that if the policy has been developed or already exists, then we give them a score of 2 to 2.5. Obviously, besides policy, you need governance and implementation machinery and institutional reforms to carry out. So the score is assigned on the basis of the level of progress. And lastly, the implementation gets the score. So each of those 91 indicators then gets score on the basis of these three parameters, on the basis of the data available. And then we also have rules for assigning 0 if the progress has been reversed. And no negative marking is done because we believe that this would affect the average, the non-weighted average, disproportionately. We assign 0 if no progress is made. And we also note that since it is the very beginning and it's still the first year of a democratic government, which has full 5 years, so we write as yet no development in the indicators in which no development has taken place. The key difference between as yet no development and zero or nil is that in the latter, as yet no development, the score of that area is then computed, is not computed in computing the average. So we give a fair margin of the government to the government in terms of perform over next 4 years. And then the average of the subcomponents are taken, and then we assign to the overall areas. The PMLN manifesto, and if you can turn to the next slide, please. This is how the scorecard looks like. As I already explained, on the left side column, you have the first chapter of Manifesto Economic Revival. This is just an example. And in the right columns, you have all those scores mentioned, with the second column showing the data in terms of baseline. The baseline is chosen as 10th June 2013. That is the time when the government took over. So we assign scores on three areas: economic revival, energy security,
try to get this link back. So meanwhile, while we try to get the link back, I'm just going to shoot a quick email to Ali and let him know that the phone line is down. So please pardon me. Maybe while we try to get the link back, we could actually ask Khurram to make a few quick remarks so that we're not here we go. All right, so we're going to try to get the link back, but just maybe give a couple quick remarks, and then we'll try to turn it back over to Ali.
Okay, okay. Actually, I don't have much to say about the methodology other than perhaps some concern regarding how weightage is going to be assigned to the various criteria, the legislative and policy developments, institutional reforms and implementation. Because some of the measures that are being talked about are more difficult than others. It's easier to pass legislation, it's harder to implement it. And so perhaps, as per the methodology, I'm not sure. I think both would end up carrying the same weight. And it might be worth, in subsequent reports, to actually assign weightages. Of course, that becomes a very subjective enterprise. And number two, some of these promises are easier to deliver on than others. So clearly, it's a way where the methodology can focus the attention on some of them, rather than just giving us a numerical value for each. It's entirely possible Ali already has ideas on all of this. So perhaps once we've had a chance to hear him out on that. Number two, the baseline, the choice of the baseline. Now, 10th June 2013 is definitely when the political career of the government began, but the economy actually had been operating from long before. So it's a bit tricky actually to establish a baseline in these kinds of assessments, because depending on where you set the baseline, you're going to get a different result, and it might be worth giving a little more thought to how that'll work.
Apologies for that. We're just gonna try to reestablish the connection.
Hello, this is Ali.
Hello, Ali. Not sure what happened there. We lost you for a minute, but we are happy to hear you back in action. So please feel free to continue the presentation. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We are on slide number 4, economic revival, and I was just explaining a few scores. Now, you can see on the right side column, various scores have been assigned, and the total score out of 10 in the economic revival government has received score of 4.47. And in the second row on the top, you actually are seeing the overall score, which is the aggregate score of the three components. Now, let me give you a perspective here. For instance, the targets set in the tax reforms, tax administration, lowering of tax rates, facilitation of tax collection for the taxpayers, increasing the tax to GDP ratio. These are all, there are about 15 subcomponents which contribute to an assessment of where the government is standing in terms of tax reforms. And as you can see, this is the lowest score which the government has received, is 1.75. out of these 10 components in economic revival, and we view this as
sorry to interrupt, Ali. Could you clarify what slide you're on, please?
Yeah, sorry. This is slide number 4, economic revival.
Great, thank you. We're with you.
Yeah. So I was explaining the tax reforms issue, in which this out of the 10. Scored subcomponents, the government has received the lowest score. Similarly, the state-owned enterprises, government has promised to sort of start the privatization, and the process has begun, but it seems that the process is rather slow at the moment. There are opportunities for Pakistan in terms of industrial growth and also trade development. Like Pakistan has received GSP plus status from the EU, the concessionary tariff regime. So we hope that this will be used as this will be used to boost up the trade and the exports from Pakistan. There are some indicators that the private sector has actually grown in terms of, for instance, its excess or its usage of the commercial credit over 1 year has grown exponentially. And when you compare this figure in terms of 1 year, the private sector credit has increased by 4 times. So these are all the factors which have been considered while giving scores in various components which right now are in the front of your screen. And as I said, just to repeat my point, the score in the area of economic revival is 4.47. If there are any clarification questions on this slide, I'll be happy to stop for a second before moving on.
No, please continue.
Okay, so then let's turn to the next slide, please, which is again one of the most important area which the government is now targeting, the energy security. You can see the results in 10 components. And as I said earlier, the PMLN party has actually done a good job in terms of defining their exact goals of how, for instance, they are going to sustain or they are going to ensure energy security for the country. However, the very first goal which they announced has not been achieved. For an integrated energy policy, the institutional arrangement decided was that we will have one integrated Ministry of Energy and Natural Resources, but we have not achieved that. So you don't see any development in that area. Then you can see various components of the energy sector. One area of maybe your interest would be number 5, which is the permanent elimination of circular debt. Circular debt is the payment which are stuck in the system because of defaults and because of the poor collection of bills by state enterprises or by even by private customers. Although this government temporarily solved this problem last year by paying around $5 billion in one go, which was the outstanding component, which was the outstanding payment to the electricity producing companies. The outstanding debt in this sector is about $3.5 billion. So therefore, you can see in the area 5, circular debt, the score is low at 3.25. Area number 9, high priority to import gas through pipelines, may be of interest to our friends in U.S. because the government committed, for instance, that it will meet the shortfall in gas by pipeline agreements within the region. And obviously, due to the geopolitical situation, not much progress has been made on this. So the score is low at 2. There are certain reforms beginning to happen, but the pace of the institutional reforms is rather slow at the moment. And in the energy sector, we have seen China being very actively pursuing various investment opportunities in Pakistan. We can say that we are expecting positive development, but so far mostly the agreements are yet to be materialized. There are MOUs signed, but in exception of one agreement, there are many energy related areas in which more investment is needed. So we continue on this area, energy security, and move on to next slide. This should be slide number 6. This is the continuation of energy security, remaining five components. And you can see that in the very first area, development of new coal fields and setting up of new coal-fired power plants, there is a high score of 7. Pakistan, it is well known in the area of southern Punjab, southern Pakistan, province of Sindh. Pakistan has very vast reserves of coal or lignite. It is not exactly coal, but there is an immense opportunity for investment into of energy. And the government have signed up projects and have started projects recently or commissioned projects recently in that area. Pakistan had also exhibited a potential in hydropower, but then there has been a lot of political tensions and resistance by smaller provinces on certain dams, and therefore there has been no development in that area. Pakistan does have alternative energy like solar energy and other sources, and there have been positive progress in that as well. Ultimately, the government has declared that they want to establish a sort of a wholesale market for electricity. It is a very ambitious goal, but what we see is something different happening. The government has announced, for instance, direct contracting with companies in discussions with China, with Russia, with Turkey, and so direct contracting has its own issues, and the score is nil at this moment in terms of development of the wholesale energy market. So the energy sector, the final result is the score is 4.34 out of 10. And now I'm going to move to the next slide, which is the third and the last area in our assessment. This is relatively very few indicators are available, in which the government has continued the previous government, People's Party government program of Benazir Income Support Program, and it has actually increased the amount available in what is well-managed conditional cash transfer. And therefore, the government has received a high score of 7. And also, the spending on non-pension social protection has increased in last budget. Although there is another province promise on the agenda, legislate the right to food, but so far no development has been happening. There is a discrepancy, as you can see, that we only have 3 indicators in this area. So obviously, as compared with 15 components in the energy security or 10 components in economic revival, we only have 3. Average will still be computed, and it has, you can say, a slightly disproportionate effect on the overall score. And just to summarize now, this is the summary slide, slide number 8, overall score for your reference. This is where relatively Pakistan economic performance in the light of manifesto of the government and in the light of our assessment stands right now. About 4.47 in economic revival, 4.34 in energy security and social protection, 6.5, leading to an average of 5.1. Now, just to put you in perspective, when we did this score in January, the overall score was 4.4. So you can see that there has been some increase in the performance. From 4.4, the overall performance is at my 5.1. Now, we can also say that government has also made some efforts to reduce the size of government as well as lessen taxation and regulatory burden overall in the economy. Now, what are the priority areas where the government should be moving? Again, we have identified certain areas from the manifesto which need government attention. One of this is actually reduction in the government expenditure, and not just the expenditure on the presidency or prime minister secretariat. Then the government must gear up its effort on the privatization of state-owned enterprises. And one important prerequisite for that is the setting up of independent and professional boards and introducing corporate governance in the state-owned enterprises, which was legislated last year. Incidentally, also SAIP, Pakistan, played a positive role in that. Then we continue to the next slide, number 10. And we emphasize that the government must reduce the number of federal and provincial taxes and also the rate of taxes. Need to encourage more people to actually bring in the tax net rather than encouraging them to evade the taxation. Government has geared up its efforts to open up trade with India and also increased its efforts in Afghanistan. But our view is that it has stopped short of granting MFN status to India, apparently for security and political reasons at the moment. In our view, it must go on and open up the borders further. There is an apprehension in the business circles that government is, in the name of regulation, maybe extending and its control over the business through arbitrary controls on the regulators, such as Security and Exchange Commission and Competition Commission. That needs to be avoided. The regulatory environment has to be maintained as an independent regulators. Lastly, the government needs to continue its, you know, improve its relationship with the private sector. Now, the next slide is with how you can actually ensure the energy security in this country. In the past, it has happened that we have given subsidies to the consumers and extraordinary incentives to the energy producers, but we have not really come closer to an open and competitive energy market, particularly in the transmission and distribution, and also partially in generation, which has meant that Pakistan is significantly facing shortfall of energy, and the business and industries are all waiting for sort of revival in terms in energy infrastructure. And therefore, we believe that this has to be continued as one of the top most important priority for this government. Right. So I think I'm done with the slides. I'm again thankful to all of you in DC this morning, and we can take questions right now or later after other guests have spoken.
Great. Thank you very much, Ali. That's a very comprehensive view of the government's policies and how they've done in the past 9 months in implementing them. I'd like to turn it over, I should say, back over to Mr. Hussein, who's obviously a very well-regarded columnist and journalist in Pakistan, in residence at the Wilson Center, and very knowledgeable about all aspects of Pakistani politics and policy. So turn it over to you. Thanks.
Thanks, Robert, for that very kind introduction. And also a shout out to Ali Salman in Islamabad for a great job done with preparing these or tracking these manifesto targets so carefully and so closely. Like this, I've already shared a couple of thoughts regarding the methodology that's being followed here. So I'd like to, react to the picture that's emerging from or what this report is actually telling us. Number one, there is very little doubt that the overall economic story of this new government in Pakistan is a positive one thus far. And by and large, the tracking report is actually showing that too. The improvement between the last report and this one in overall achievement of targets is speaking to that. All of the various institutional voices, the independent institutional voices whose job it is to track macroeconomic and structural developments in the economy closely, concur on this point. The State Bank of Pakistan in its monetary policy announcements has echoed a very positive sentiment. The IMF in its first and second review has also echoed a very positive sentiment that by and large things appear to be moving in the right direction. GDP growth rate growth is increasing, large scale manufacturing is leading this turnaround. The fiscal deficit and expenditures are under control, revenue measures are being implemented. So by and large, there appears to be a very positive story coming out, and I think Ali Salman's report and the report by SAIP is also echoing that. It's not certainly giving us any reason to doubt what the IMF and the State Bank have already told us. Now, having said that, it's also equally important to understand, I think, that this was in fact the easy part. Turning around the overall macroeconomic indicators was quite possibly the first order of priority for sure, but the part of the story that came the easiest, number one. The real story begins now, And that's something that occurred to me even more so. And I think the last two slides that Ali Salman showed us, the 10 bullet pointed one, the priorities going forward. If you look at each one of those points that were that was on the screen, you really get the feeling that the game is only just beginning. And the third review of the IMF that is scheduled for May will be held, and then shortly after that, whatever agreed targets come out of that review will be written into the budget in June. And that fiscal year and the implementation of those structural and the pursuit of those structural reforms is really where the game is going to be, get going in earnest. Before going on to that, let me just add that the government has been helped along in turning around the macroeconomic picture by a couple of things. One was the arrival of unanticipated liquidity from abroad. The reserve target, the government was in a very tight reserves position up until December of the fiscal year, and there was not really a clear picture going forward about how they intend to meet their net international reserves targets and how they're going to be able to bring about currency stability, which had been an important part of the promises that they had made. So suddenly the arrival of $1.5 billion out of nowhere certainly helped turning around the reserves picture. The other is on the fiscal side. There was a considerable amount of help given to the government by the fact that last year, right before the end of the last fiscal year, there was a retirement of about 582 billion rupees worth of the circular debt. That was done days before the end of the fiscal year last year. And the reason behind doing it days before was so that money, in fact, gets counted in last year's fiscal deficit figures, which are now being reported as 8.8% of GDP. Of course, this year you will not have a retirement on that order of magnitude, plus with such a high base from 8.8%, bringing the deficit down to a target of 5.8% will be helped along. The fiscal side has also been helped by including in the revenue figures figures that have traditionally not been included in fiscal areas, such as the universal support fund maintained by the telecom companies for making telecom infrastructure accessible to the poor. That's been brought under government control, whereas it used to be an independent fund. They've also been helped along by an unusually high provincial government surpluses, which in the last report I saw before coming here was at 170 billion rupees, more than half of which was accounted for by the government of Punjab. The previous government struggled with this issue and struggled with trying to get the government of Punjab to run a provincial surplus to bring some of that that money back into. But going forward, so the macroeconomic picture has been helped along by cleverly adjusting the baseline, and it's also been helped along by the utilization of liquidity. But nevertheless, there is a resumption of confidence that the recent Eurobond flotation, for instance, shows that the return of confidence is not only a domestic factor, but international investors looking at Pakistan also feel that it's potentially a good bet for 5 to 10 year tenors, even if at unusually high spreads. Going forward, the real challenges now emanate on the structural side. Those targets are going to be decided in May, and implementation is then going to begin as of the forthcoming budget. Two areas are going to be absolutely central and critical to this, and Ali Salman's presentation touched on both of them, in fact gave central place to both of them. One is tax administration and the other is energy. This is where the government is going to meet its biggest test, because this is where they start touching on the real rackets that operate beneath the surface, and how they deal with this, how they go about bringing the two power bureaucracies under control, the power bureaucracy and the tax bureaucracy, is going to be an important test. So that's something to keep an eye on. I suppose I can stop here at this point if you want to open discussion.
Thanks very much. To open up the discussion, let me just thank all of our speakers for excellent, very interesting and detailed presentation on the state of Pakistan's economic policy. A question that I had for Ali and as well for Mark and Khurram At the end, Ali, you had a list of recommendations. First of all, are you still on the line, Ali?
Yeah, I am hearing.
Oh, excellent. Good. So we don't have to repeat ourselves. As the state privatizes some of the state-owned enterprises, that obviously reduces its revenue. If you're recommending as well reductions in tax and reductions in government debt, obviously that will have an effect on government revenue as well. Where is the government going to get money to invest in infrastructure that is needed? Obviously the international community is a potential source, but it's not clear to me that increasing dependence on international aid is a policy that anybody's really recommending. Would you care to speak to that issue?
Yes, I think it's a very important issue. Now, first of all, I think we need to understand, and the government would create surplus capital and financial fiscal space for investment in the infrastructure once it stops subsidizing and once it stops spending its money on the loss-making enterprises. There is estimated about $5 billion every year the government throws its money after bad. And then there is another $5 billion estimated by IMF, which is the revenue loss due to tax exemptions. The concessionary regimes called SROs in Pakistan. Now, these are the sources available within the current fiscal space in Pakistan. And I think the priority, therefore, should be to create this and to materialize this kind of money which is on the table to be available for investment over the next few years. The taxation issue is very sensitive, and I noticed that when I say that lowering the tax rate, there is a concern that maybe because of poor administration, Pakistan GDP ratio, tax GDP ratio may even further slide down. But I am very confident that this government actually had achieved in late 90s a fairly high tax to GDP ratio, close to 13%. By actually reducing and simplifying tax structure. It was unfortunately 2002 onwards when we had made a very complicated income tax code, and furthermore, even more complicated sales tax or value-added tax regime. We have moved from a simplified tax to complicated tax, and we have lost revenue. So I think these are the resources available within the country. And I totally agree that we don't need to depend on aid. The foreign aid is hardly 1% of national GDP. I don't consider this as a major driving factor. I mean, there could be, as Khurram rightly pointed out, there's one transaction which has helped for now. But I don't think so that we should plan or assume that more such transactions are on the line. And we have to look inside for resources.
From what I understand, this government has been quite, or this party has been quite innovative in being able to raise funds for infrastructure finance in the past. And the kind of things we're hearing them talk about today indicates that, you know, the Prime Minister has spoken about a build-operate transfer basis, for instance, for financing some highway projects. So I think raising resources will not be that big of a problem for them, depending on the terms that they're willing to offer to the. But the thing is that recovering that money over the course of the next few years will be a big issue. So you're right to flag this as a problem where the funds will come from for infrastructure finance, but.
The failure of the 3G, 4G auction recently, it seems to me a real weather. They were expecting $2 billion and got something on the score of bids for what, about 400 million or something. So I just wonder.
Well,
if
I mean, what's the with the 3G auction? It's yet to take place on the it will take place on the 23rd. First of all, so we'll know at that point. Now, what's happened is that Reuters has run a story saying that, as per their sources, and they're not citing any named sources, they're claiming that the government has only raised $850 million based on the sealed bids that were submitted on Monday. The government, for its part, particularly the chairman of the Telecommunications Authority, has very strongly gone on the record to deny this, and saying that, and says, in fact, because he's seen the sealed bids, he's saying that no, the, in fact, the auction is oversubscribed. So we don't yet know what the we'll know on the 23rd what the outcome of that is, first of all. Second, the amount that they're actually looking for from the auction, if you look at the IMF documents, for the balance of payments, the target is about $1.2 billion that they're looking to raise from that auction, of which about something like $200 million, I believe, has already been raised. So it's just $1 billion that's from the auction itself. The Reuters report is saying, well, they've raised $850 million. So even the shortfall there is not as big as what the report is making us believe. The $2 billion figure is just a figure that the finance minister had put up, I think, back in January after a cabinet meeting. So the real figure is actually $1.2
billion. So as usual, more positive picture than at this point.
Yeah.
Excellent. When I call on you, please please turn on the microphone, introduce yourself, and then keep your question fairly brief so that we can get as much discussion as possible. Thanks.
Yes, Andrew Wilson from SIPE. Ali, your presentation seems to indicate that as with a lot of governments, that the current government's very good at spending and still has some challenges in income. One of the issues that's plagued Pakistan over the years has been not only expanding the tax base, but making sure that people who do owe taxes pay their taxes in full, and that's always been a question, especially, I guess, in terms of rural land holders. What progress has this government made, not only in simplifying the taxes you've already indicated, but expanding the tax base or making sure that taxpayers are paying their fair share?
Good question. Ali?
Yeah. Thank you so much for this very important question. I'm afraid that, as our scorecard is also showing, on the tax, government has received the lowest score on the tax reforms so far. So my immediate answer to this question is that, one, the federal government is now consistently saying that, for instance, the imposition of agriculture tax or income tax on the agriculture income is a provincial domain after the devolution constitution amendment. So it's not really bothered to carry out the expansion of the tax in that area. But it really, it has not moved ahead in terms of expanding the tax net at the moment. There is, as we know, that there is like this large informal sector economy in Pakistan. By any estimate, it is not less than 1/3 of the GDP, the national GDP. And so therefore, these are all the taxable enterprises, which are operating extra legal sphere, but which are not in tax. So my answer to this question is, I have not seen so far government making any serious attempts to reform the tax collection and tax infrastructure, except maybe that it has published recently directives of taxpayers, so it has brought some media attention to those who are paying taxes or those who are paying very low taxes. So that has stirred a lot of media debate, and it will in coming days. It was just released yesterday. But I haven't seen, in terms of the reforms, in terms of outreach, the government has to take the private sector into confidence that it means serious business, and it needs to show confidence in those small enterprises, which constitutes 90% of our enterprises, to encourage them to register themselves and identify themselves and contribute to the national taxation.
The government has committed with the IMF to send out something like 70,000 income tax notices to non-filers. The IMF is reporting close to 68,000 of those have been sent out. So a very spirited effort appears to have been made. And this is a measure that for about the last government tried to do for about 3 separate years and was unable to. So we've actually seen one major tax administration effort, to at least on the income tax side. The problem is that out of the 68,000 income tax notices that were sent out, something like 6,500 of those people actually stepped forward in response to the notice and filed. So you've got a hit rate of about less than 1 in 10. Now, how to improve that hit rate in the subsequent years is an important challenge, and that's a challenge on the structural side of things. That's a way to try and improve the tax administration, the audit powers, and maybe even legislative changes to try and reduce the role of the fact is that presents a challenge. On the sales tax side, the government had in its first budget included some very some measures to try and get people to get themselves registered as sales tax agents, but there was a big hue and cry from within the business community against that, and they caved in. Now, these were measures that the previous government had also tried on about 3 or 4 occasions, and if you look at the past 20 years, you notice that it's been tried on numerous occasions, and each time the backlash from the business community is too much and the government usually caves in. This one was no different. So, and the IMF actually frowned on that, caving in, so to speak. And then there was also a tax amnesty scheme given to a big capital, the operators of large scale fixed capital, that if you invest a certain amount of money, you can actually claim a tax exempt status for, you know, based on the amount of money that you've invested, which again the IMF flagged as a tax amnesty scheme and frowned on the practice. So you've got a mixed record emerging. You know, you can definitely see the government trying to make an effort on the income tax side, and then finding that there are structural constraints. Now, whether or not they follow up on those structural constraints is something we'll wait to see in subsequent years. On the sales tax side, you're seeing a lack of will to actually confront the unregistered parties. And on the large-scale fixed capital side, you're seeing a willingness to play ball, so to speak. And in an effort to try and get the tax compliance and amount of revenue up by through some kind of a negotiated process.
Yeah, Pete Gauthier with USAID. Two quick questions. I guess first would be on the private capital. I think you mentioned that credit's grown about 5 times. And where's that credit going? Because it doesn't seem to be going to, you know, like the heart of the economy, with like the SME sector. Is it just going to like these large big businesses on the international side? And then the second would be on the privatization. Is where are the priority sectors that you see that the privatization should focus, and where is it going to be focused going forward?
Ali?
Yeah, so the first question is, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
First question is where the additional private sector credit is going. And now the data available with the state bank shows that it has invested in very diverse proportion, from the textiles to the services. And now you should realize that the 60% of Pakistan GDP is essentially services. Which includes the wholesale and retail operations, the hotel industry, and the other services, which are actually the recipients of extra private sector credit takeoff, happened last year. Also, people have invested in the agriculture activities. Agriculture growth has been stable over the long run, and it has actually, at several occasions, has compensated for low performance in the industrial activity. As for the second question, in terms of the priorities for privatization, right now the government is actually going for a low-hanging fruit, and the low-hanging fruit is essentially capital market transactions. It is offloading, it has offered to offload its shares in banks, in large oil and gas development corporation, and other certain other large entities in which the government is a significant shareholder, though it is not in the management position. The other priorities which the government is focusing or announced is a couple of electricity utility companies. And sort of the big names in privatization, like Pakistan International Airlines, Pakistan Railways, have, it seems to me that they have been shelved at the moment. The railway minister in charge is actually against the idea of privatization, so it's not going to be privatized in any time sooner. Pakistan International Airlines, the national flag carrier, is again, you know, there are efforts to sort of improve its corporate governance. They've also are, you know, about to purchase new aircrafts on dry lease or wet lease, but again, I don't see it going towards privatization anytime soon, and I'm also afraid that there is already a political opposition to it, to the entire idea of privatization. In the previous regime, there were a lot of additional employment generated in those state-owned enterprises, and that's not easy to get rid of now that. It's very important to understand that in the last government, there in terms of the law, the there is a 12.5% share of for employees of all state-owned enterprises, and it has been already implemented in the previous regime, and unless the government revises that law, which governs all transaction of privatization. Or manage a sort of a golden shake hand or other schemes, I think that remains a sort of that will decrease the appetite, I would say, for private sector investors in the privatization transaction.
More questions?
Yeah, Ali, thanks very much. This is John Sampson from International Relief and Development. One of the areas mentioned in your report was the lack of confidence of the private sector, particularly in the economic revival. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that, as well as I'd be interested to know how specifically you're tracking that confidence measure for this report. Thanks.
Thank you. Ali.
Yeah. Thank you. As I said, we measure essentially on the basis of what the manifesto stated, and in our detailed report, I hope that you have access to a detailed report we issued the email some time back. You mentioned that the government had announced the creation of a business council and an economic advisory council in which the private sector is a participant, and it has already created that. It has met several times, and so it is sort of showing some kind of confidence. However, we also looked at the other available measures of private sector confidence. There are other surveys available. For instance, there is this Overseas Chamber of Commerce, which is the representation of all multinationals in Pakistan, which recently issued its survey about business confidence in the economic fundamentals. And it, you know, the situation it portrayed was not very hopeful. It showed very slight improvement over the last few months in terms of its confidence in the government economic policy. So our assessment is affected both by what these confidence measures have resulted in terms of how business community is seeing that, and also what government own promises for.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kat Cooley from DAI. I'm not sure, but I think some of the
authority that pushes these or some of the indicators forward has been devolved and really runs at a provincial level. So I was wondering if you could speak to some of the more nuanced differences in pace of reform or intensity or thoroughness of reform between Punjab and Sindh specifically. And also if there's anything going on to close the gap between some of the other provinces where I think there's some big disparity.
Thank you very much.
So the question is on the provincial, can you repeat the question for me, please?
It's at the, since a lot of authorities have been devolved to the provincial level, I think the question has to do with the capacity for the national government to implement all of these and how that affects the pace of reform. Is that?
Yeah, and to what extent, if you were to tease indicators just related to Punjab out of the national averages, what kind of disparity would you find, and is there any effort to close that gap?
Thank you.
Yeah. So actually, after the devolution took place, province of Sindh has established its own authority for tax collection. Province of Punjab has also followed. This is the collection on services for sales tax or the value added tax. The income tax, the custom duties, and other direct taxation and most of the indirect taxation still remains with the federal government. In most of the economic policy matters, the federal government still has the lead in terms of the decision making. There is an increasing role for an interprovincial body in which the provinces are represented, Economic Coordination Council, chaired by the Prime Minister, which has the authority to take decisions at national level. So by and large, I would say that for instance, the sales tax, the collection of sales tax on services has been devolved. Province of Sindh has actually shown a good promise. The collection by the provincial authority has actually increased. And Punjab is likely to follow, but so far I don't have figures with Punjab government. But I know for sure that Sindh government actually showed much more greater collection in terms of sales tax than it was done in the federal government time. Our scorecard, however, there are very few factors which we had to exclude, and it didn't affect much in terms of the overall assessment of the economic situation. I hope that I correctly get your question.
Great. Thanks very much.
Hi, this is Leah Gregg, also from DAI. And I was wondering, could you speak more to, within the Economic Revival Scorecard, job opportunities and job creation, and kind of go a little more in depth into what that's measuring and what are some of the policy development or implementation that the government has been moving towards?
Yeah, sure. Now, this government had announced a couple of schemes for job creation at the national level. One of the scheme is called the Prime Minister Youth Business Loan Scheme, which is actually targeted at the disbursement of loans. And so far, six to nine months in progress, we can see that progress has happened in that particular area. The other measure for this particular indicator was the extent of private sector credit, which I have already noted has increased in last one year. So on the basis of that, we have this notion that job opportunities are being created. However, there is also an additional point here. The Pakistan Bureau of Statistics recently also released an assessment of unemployment situation in the country. Although there's a lot of problem, to be honest, with its methodology and definition of what is unemployment, but the official statistics are that unemployment in Pakistan is about 5.5%, But it's really hard to believe. So I would say we will stick to what the government has promised in its manifesto and where how we do assess it.
Mr. Zain, I wonder if you could comment as well sort of on the overall economic situation in Pakistan, particularly the job situation and the energy crisis, and your thoughts on the direction that that is going now and some of the steps that the government you think should take.
Regarding employment, I've always found the numbers put out by the Bureau of Statistics to be very, very problematic. I find it very hard to work with them. That's because I've dealt directly with business people, and I'll give you one example. I went to an industrial estate, one of the largest in Pakistan, and I wanted to know how many people they hire, how many people they employ. And I was told by the chairman of that industrial estate that they themselves don't maintain that data. They said that most of the people we hire is on contract labor. They're with us today, they're gone tomorrow. Most workers in Pakistan work under those terms. They have a job today, they may not have it tomorrow. And the wages are indexed to minimum wage, although in many cases they're being paid less than minimum wage. But even the factory owners themselves don't maintain the data of how many people they hired. At the end of the month, the factory owner himself can't tell you how many people he hired, because they literally hire people, they work, they're paid out in cash, and then they leave. They've got some idea on their permanent payroll, but total employment figures, if factory people themselves don't have it, if employers themselves don't have it, I don't see how the state can. So I have a very hard time actually running with employment data. So it becomes very difficult to say whether or not this sort of economic turnaround the government is touting is one that creates employment or whether it's one that's that creates profits only and no jobs. It's difficult to say. We can surmise, but there's no real quantitative grounds you can put it on. Regarding the energy crisis, I mean, you wanted overall thoughts or. This is a long-term problem. There are two major issues that the government is up against, and you know we've had three governments try to tackle these issues and fail in the process. So we're waiting to see whether this government proves itself any different. Issue number one is the deteriorating fuel mix over the past quarter century or so. The role that oil is playing in the generation of electricity has been growing bigger and bigger, and up until 2002-2003 that wasn't seen as a big problem because oil wasn't that expensive, and much of the thermal requirements for the power plants came from indigenous natural gas. But from 2002 till now, in the past one decade, oil prices have shot up and natural gas production has come down, and number of stakeholders on the natural gas side has increased as well. So with this double whammy, in fact, diminishing supplies of indigenous gas, rising costs of imported oil, that's really at the root of what we call the power crisis. It's not that there's not enough capacity to generate the electricity, it's that there isn't enough capacity to pay for the electricity that we can generate. So much of the generation capacity sits idle. And number two is, of course, the power bureaucracy. This is one of the most powerful bureaucracies in the country. And I've had a chance to see it up close. In the year 2008, I made a documentary series on the power crisis in which I actually went to and stayed for a few days in each of the power plants, the public sector power plants in Pakistan. I spent a few days over there interacting with them in each of them. And then also in the coal fields in Lakra. And it was very easy to see that the inefficiencies that are there, and the enormous difficulty that the independent board of governors that were installed by the last government were having in ensuring compliance. And the last government installed independent boards on each of the distribution companies. And the boards found that the management just was not responding to them, just not taking instructions, not complying with any directives. So getting the power bureaucracy to actually respond to reform-minded initiatives is a big challenge. And the Musharraf government tried it, the previous government tried it. We'll wait to see if this government manages to succeed. Of course, one wishes that they do.
Thanks very much. Mark, the same basic question, what are your thoughts on the overall situation of poverty and jobs? in Pakistan and know what you think needs to be done?
Well, you know, I mean, I think to a certain extent I have to kind of sidestep your question because sort of from a, you know, I think there's two reasons. First of all, you know, sort of from a SIPE point of view, we tend to defer to the experts in terms of commenting on the very specifics. But also, I think from an overall point of view, also, I think as both Ali and Khurram have pointed out, you know, there are a lot of structural and institutional arrangements that also need to be negotiated, I think, going forward. You know, Ali's report very clearly indicates, I think, that there's a certain amount of momentum and that there's a certain amount of there are a certain amount of positive signs and changes that have been introduced. But you know, Khurram rightly pointed out also that it's in terms of the structural arrangements and the institutional arrangements and the implementation, you know, where the rubber is going to really meet the road. I think both Ali and Khurram have also pointed to the difficulties in getting the statistics right. You know, I think the one thing that I hear coming from both of their comments is that to some extent the government is in a little bit of a difficult position where they have these dueling pressures of economic revival, which would seem to, let's say, mitigate in favor of relaxing certain tax burdens on the private sector. Yet at the same time, we also know that the IMF, as Khurram pointed out, is putting a lot of pressure in terms of ramping up tax collection. And that was something that was also, I think, reflected in Andrew's question as well. So those dueling pressures are there. So, you know, I think very much so the jury is still out.
Ali, we have about, Mr. Sullivan, please.
Go on. Just a very small, well, it's actually a very large question, but it's a very small point. And that is, if you're in the private sector and you're running a company and you don't know how much you've spent on employment, how can you put together a P&L sheet?
I don't know. You know, they will have aggregate data on how much they've put into their company in terms of, you know, they'll have two separate payrolls for one. The one that's for the contract labor, which is where the bulk of their work is coming from.
Maybe a third one?
A third one for the taxpayer, maybe, tax collector, maybe. But there'll be one for the contract labor that is hired on the day-to-day basis, which is the majority of the workforce. And then there'll be another one for the permanent. And that data they'll have. They'll have an HR department and they'll be able to tell you. But how many people have actually worked there over the past 1 month, they won't be able to tell you, but they might be able to tell you what their total bill was over the past 1 month, what they paid. But how many people that represented, we don't know. So, you know, that makes it difficult to assess how many people entered the workforce. You might be able to get some data on how much they paid in a monthly period or something, but it'll be very hard for you to get numbers of people that are entering the workforce, basically.
So it sounds like both the public and the private sectors have some reforms that they need to undertake. Usefully so. Ali, we have about 30 seconds remaining, so I'll give you the final word.
Yeah, it's a pleasure being all of you. One final thought I wanted to share is that I think the audience and the friends of Pakistan in Washington, D.C. needs to look Pakistan beyond, I would say, the security lens or security perspective. Not happening in Pakistan in terms of economic activity.
Well, we've lost Ali, but that's okay. His point is well taken, and in fact, that's something that our program has done the last few years. We did a lot of work on
security, the security relationship between the United States and Pakistan. But about 2-3 years ago, we really started shifting the focus to more private sector development, trade issues. In fact, right now, my fellow Sadiqa Hamid is in Pakistan, wrapping up this year's study on the state of investment and entrepreneurship in Pakistan, which will be out sometime in the next few months. With apologies to Ali, which we'll send separately, I'd like to thank Ali Saman of Prime, Khurram Hussein of the Wilson Center, and Mark, John, and Jennifer of SIPE for organizing this, and thank all of you for coming today.